My main subject for tonight is the human-animal bond. Bond is a very strong word, mother-child bond. When one member of the bond will give its life for another, you're talking about a very close attachment. And this also occurs with animals and people on very close bonding. When one will give its life for another, in most cases, it's usually the animal that gives its life. I will also touch a bit on animal-facilitated therapy, but the title of my subject, I think, on Wednesday will be animal-facilitated therapy, but I'll just give you a slight taste of it tonight. I'll also be talking about the Delta Society, which is devoted to the interaction of people, animals, and the environment. It's a fairly new society. It's had an office since September of 83, and I'm its president. When we talk of bond, when we were planning our international congress, our last international congress for the Delta Society in Boston last year, last August, it was as I was quoted in Newsweek, it's the biggest thing since the Ark on human-animal interaction. And it was. There were over 1,000 people there from 18 countries with 200 presentations. But for this conference, we felt that we needed a poster that, just looking at the poster, you'd know this is the human-animal bond. And what we picked was this photograph of Kubla, Kubla and Wayne. And when I saw it, I knew there had to be a story behind it. So I'm going to give you this story. Obviously, that's a very close bonding. Kubla, as you may not be able to tell from where you are, and you're better off sitting off to one side or the other, those of you who are coming in, if you want to see the slide. But Kubla is a hippopotamus, a young one, fortunately for Wayne. His leg is probably already asleep, but he's obviously in having his lunch at Woodland Park Zoo. Kubla's life started in a Portland zoo. He was born and he was without a mother, so they hand-reared him and introduced him to a Barbary sheep. They thought he should have some animal association. He wasn't very old. I should say he was born on September 14th, 1975. When he was not very old, they moved him to the Woodland Park Zoo, which was fortunate for both Kubla and Wayne. Wayne Williams was a remarkable zookeeper. He's from Montana and Wyoming. He had a special way about him with large animals, and some people have great talent for that, and he did. And he really took to Kubla, and Kubla took to him. A very strong bond developed. But he thought, for Kubla's sake, he should be introduced to his own kind. So he arranged to have him introduced to another hippopotamus, a mother hippopotamus. But he set it up in the elephant cage, or in the elephant area, because if he ran into trouble, hardly anybody argues with an elephant. And so this seemed to be a great threat to Kubla, as you can see the concern in his eye. And he's looking for comfort, which he found. I don't know if you've ever seen a hippopotamus sit like a dog, but now you have. And he's telling his troubles to Wayne, being still what he terms assaulted by the hippopotamus. So they brought in the elephant, and that separated them. I point out here that, for those of you whose zoos are not your native tongue or zoo animals, I have been told, although I'm not a specialist in hippopotamus, although I did sneak into Tanzania from Kenya when the border was closed so I could see some, but this is a term of friend. This is a method of friendly greeting. So if a hippopotamus comes at you like this, You better run, but if you're brave, it's probably a term of affection. Kubla didn't learn that right away, but then when he got to be big, he did. He's had no issues yet, but they found out that his mate was taking birth control pills. So he hasn't been fully tested. But this is the story of Kubla and the human-animal bond. And we proceed now to my own family. My wife complained a lot about me being gone so much when we were at the University of California. And so I, of course, listened to her, and we got a hold of this dog. And she said, "What should we call it?" And I said, "Well, we'll call it Great Reluctance, so that whenever I leave you, I can leave you with great reluctance." And it worked. Now, I should say, I'm giving you a historical perspective today, and in recalling early times, this would be considered a lap dog in the Middle Ages, when physicians would prescribe, especially to women with abdominal problems, they would prescribe a lap dog. Or if you were going crazy, they'd issue you a dog to carry around. We know now that there is scientific basis for this. My wife drives a white rabbit. She doesn't drive it very well, but she drives it. And here she's driving it. And this shows the kind of almost pathologic bonding one sees in today's age. The caption on this is, "Although Great Reluctance is 16 years old, he still loves to chase cars." And you see things like this. But don't you see, if you have your dog in your annual report picture, the other directors will want their pets in their pictures. Now, wouldn't that look silly? Well, for those of you who follow the political scene, you would be probably interested to know that if a political candidate is observed or pictured or seen, especially pictured, with an animal, a friendly animal like usually a dog, usually not with a cat if you're a male. Maybe a female would get by with a cat, but a male would have to have a dog, and if it's a golden retriever or something like that, it'll probably increase his votes about 10 or 15%, somewhere in that range. You'll also notice if you go through the slick papers of magazines today, the slick paper magazines, on selling something that has nothing to do with animals, if an animal is pictured, it's more attractive to much of the audience. You've seen this animal. I came home 5 years ago last April 14th to my home, and my wife could no longer hear me. She had lost her hearing of her good ear that day. She'd already lost the other one with Meniere's disease. This is a very terrible disability. I had worked with hearing handicap before my wife lost her hearing, and I didn't know it was as bad as it was. I've learned a lot since then. I've learned that most people don't know how to deal with hearing handicap people. I said, "Well, we'll get you a hearing dog." And she says, "No." Since I had experience with some hearing dogs, I was involved in the placement follow-up of the first hearing dog in the Northwest, which incidentally started the first hearing dog described is in Minneapolis, Minnesota. That's another story. But she said, I said, "Well, can you spare this dog for a couple of months and I'll have Kathy train it?" And she says, "No, I can't really part with it now." I said, "Well, we'll train it to be a hearing dog. By now, it's already 4 years old. It didn't have a good upbringing. We got it at 3 years of age. And in testing it, we worked with a hearing dog center in Massachusetts. And we did some tests on it, and it didn't pass all the tests. But we went ahead anyway. I had a trainer in for almost a year, 5 minutes or so, 5 or 10 minutes a day. four or five times a week. And then we worked very closely with Terry, and we ended up with a dog that qualified as now a certified hearing dog. She has her ID with a dog that permits her to go in most states in any public building or, well, about anywhere she wants to go or fly a plane with it. She has same access as guide dogs. And now more and more states are getting also assistance dogs, which I'll talk about on Friday. So this does remarkable things for my wife. I can travel the country as I have been and be secure that she is all right at home because, most critically, of course, it'll get her to an outside door if the smoke alarm goes. Lets her know when somebody's at the door, gets her to the phone if the phone rings, or another next blessing gets her up, jumps on top of her when the alarm clock goes off. I think, in a way, when I'm gone, I'm not sure of that. She may not set the alarm when I'm not there. And this bonding is not unique to me or to our family or to Wayne or to our country or just to dogs. This happens to be in Denmark, and the one that's riding shotgun is wearing the goggles today. It's a very close bonding there. Or you can take a patient of our son's in Alaska. He had severe cardiac problems, this fellow. He hesitated, as many people do, to go to a physician and leave their animal. This fellow did catch a fast train to Anchorage and got treatment and ran back home because he was afraid that something might happen to Lady. And if something happened to Lady, it'd be end of him. And so that was a very long call for our son. He never came back, so our son, it was 200 miles away. So whenever he's up there, he'd check him out. Or this one from Dillon, Montana. This is a sheep raised by a 4-H girl, a 4-H student. She couldn't raise it in her own backyard. It didn't have enough room, so she went to the local nursing center in Dillon, Montana. And they had room, and they certainly welcomed her. She got an extra bonus because in Dillon, Montana, most of the people in the nursing home are retired sheep herders, and she got more about sheep than she planned on. But it was a great success story. In fact, the next year I went to see her. I thought that was remarkable, so I went over to Missoula, Montana, or Dillon, rather, and saw her. Then she had two sheep instead of one. The best combination for nursing and convalescent homes, incidentally, are children and animals. And when I get to be a dictator, that's how it'll be. In fact, this particular home, they also bought a dog for the manager and called it by his name, so he couldn't very well get rid of it. But the end two rooms of that nursing home is a daycare center. Well, what was that? Did I miss something? Yes. The bonding isn't only with a nice little furry cuddly things, but also with cows and other things. I know we were closely bonded with our dairy cows when I was growing up. They were all named. When you name an animal, it's part of the family. In this case, this fellow on Tiger Mountain near Issaquah had this cow for 32 years, and he cried when it died. That's longer than most people are married, and a lot fewer fights. Pigs, of course, are one of my favorites, and I'll be addressing that on Friday night. The wonder of pigs. We are one of our most sensitive of all animals and also one of our brightest. This happens to be Martha. She had her first litter when she was 65 pounds, and I had a birth announcement. I'd send her birthday cards. She's since died. To some people, birds are in. This happens to be a Nobel Prize winner named Konrad Lorenz. We had an international symposium in Austria celebrating his 80th birthday in 1983. And it was my privilege to give him the accolades for his 80th birthday from the English-speaking world. He made geese famous, and geese made him famous. He's most famous probably for his book on King Solomon's Ring. He shared the Nobel Prize on Ethology with Tim Bergen. A remarkable fellow. I met Marjorie Sykes in a small village near Sydney, Australia. I'd heard about her, so I went to see her. Birds are her life. For the last 13 years, she feeds those birds there in the village square, 7 o'clock in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. If you want to see birds in that village, you go down and see Marjorie Sykes, because you'll see most of the birds in the area. And they're keeping her going. A remarkable person. This is a drawing because this girl died before I got there. It's in St. Mary's Hospital for Children in south of London, which was also the location on their grounds for the largest at that time riding for the handicapped center in the world, the Diamond Center for the Handicapped Riding. And this girl at 12 contracted metastasizing carcinoma, and she could no longer ride. But on her good days, they would bring over her favorite pony, and they fortunately put her on the main floor so that the horse could stick its head in the window and she could have sessions with her best friend and give him a carrot or something else. Meant a very great deal to her in her last days. Or you can take you to one of my place, one of the more remarkable people I know, Dame Cicely Saunders, who is sort of the godmother of the modern hospice movement. She got the Templeton Award the year after Mother Teresa. Templeton set up the Templeton Award to be bigger than the Nobel Prize because he thought it was more important. And she plowed it all back in. What's this got to do with Dame Cicely Saunders? Well, and she's about my age, and when just a few years ago, she married this fellow who's an artist. And whenever I ask her for a picture, she sends me a picture of her husband and her cat. I guess it's his cat too. So I still haven't got a picture of Dame Cicely Saunders, who started, as I say, the modern hospice movement. I'm very interested in hospices, and I became interested in her because she has resident animals in her hospice at St. Christopher's. She also has visiting privileges for the pets. I'm presently a consultant to the Prince and Princess of Wales Hospice in Glasgow, Scotland, where with another veterinarian, hoping to convince them that at least one area should be set aside for terminal patients where they bring their animals with them. We've made such arrangements in some places. This is a grabber here. This is Carrie and Abdul from the Canine Companions for Independence. And I'll be addressing this on Friday to tell about the remarkable things happening with assistance dogs. But just to kind of whet your appetite, this was the first dog trained by Canine Companions for Independence north of San Francisco at Santa Rosa. She was dependent, lived with her mother and father. She's severely crippled, has been all her life. She has a motorized vehicle. And they trained this dog with about 90 commands. It presses the elevator buttons, opens the doors, doorbells. And she is now living independently. In fact, she's in charge of the Canine Companions for Independent Training Center at Rancho Santa Fe near San Diego. A great story. Abdul is now 9 years old. Now, I've told you about the various things happening right now. This kind of association has gone on for eons of years, thousands of years. We don't know really how long. There's some evidence for domestication with a dog, for example, of 12,000 years. Could be longer. It's interesting to look at the cave paintings and see that some of the earliest cave paintings were those of animals. We talked today about the children's dreams with campus pastor Magnuson. that 60 or 70% of the dreams of a child are of animals for their first, I guess, 6 or 7 years. These paintings and the association, early association of people with animals were not always for utilitarian purposes. There's some indication that they also kept them for other reasons, religious and among others, which I'll get into in a minute. The most famous dog in history was Argus, was Ulysses' dog. He went off on a big trip, gone for about 20 years. And when he returned, the only creature that recognized him and welcomed him was his dog, who at that time was terminally ill and confined to a dung heap, but didn't recognize him. In many cultures, in many religions throughout thousands of years, animals have been treated in varying ways. Some of them, many of them, worshipped and treated remarkably well. Egypt was one of these places. Before Christ, dogs were highly thought of, and in fact, in that constellation of stars, there is a star there, the star Sirius. And whenever, the Egyptians would, of course, watch the sky for the appearance of the star Sirius. And when it appeared, then they realized that they had to get out of the Nile Valley because it would flood. And as long as they followed that star, they would never get flooded out. But they didn't call that star Sirius. They called it the dog star because it was ever faithful. They also had a thing about cats. In about 1882 or 3, there were some diggings in Egypt, and they found, there's varying reports on it, at least 80,000, if not over 100,000, of these mummified specimens, and all individuals like this. And so they cut them open, and here's what they found. A mummified cat, the most modern methods available at that time, along with each had its own mouse for its afterlife. And the Egyptians at that time really revered cats. And if you harmed a cat or caused it to death, it might be worth your life. And when a cat died, you would shave your eyebrows and maybe your hair and go into mourning for a period of time. But this caused their downfall. They were being assaulted by a Persian king or a Syrian king in about 5 BC. And they were assaulting the city of Memphis, as I recall, and they were having a tough time of it, and the invading king heard that they were really gung-ho on cats. So he had his soldiers pick up all the cats they could find, and they catapulted them into the city. And the inhabitants of the city couldn't take that, and so they gave up the city rather than sacrifice any more cats. This is an interesting presentation here on how man and beast work together. Pliny the Elder described how dolphins would work with fishermen to catch fish. A lot of people didn't believe him, but it was again shown for sure on the Mauritanian coast in about 1500, as I recall the dates. And what would happen on these occasions is that the fishermen would go out and set their nets, and then they'd look for a shoal of mullet out breaking water. And when they'd see them, they'd splash in the water a certain way. The dolphins would move abreast, move the mullet into the nets, and then share in the take. Although we've changed remarkably in most of our cultures as far as our relationship with the natural environment and with animals and people, it is not true with some cultures such as these Maasai, which I visited some years ago in Kenya. And it's pretty much the same as it used to be and has been for thousands of years. And their life is a very close association when they bring in the livestock in their encampments at night. They bring the goats, right? They sleep with the goats. And you wonder how the world can you sleep with these goats in there making all this racket? You don't ask about smell because they both smell about the same. That is, the people and the goats. But they says, no, that's a soporific. That's how you sleep with them. They wouldn't sleep well if the goats weren't there. But it was fun to watch them. And it brings to mind my philosophy on this whole thing. That to the extent that we fracture the bond between our natural environment, that is our animals and our plants, we're a society in trouble. We by nature are nurturers, and to the extent that the early people nurtured their natural environment, the animals and people, they survived and were to an extent healthy. We are healthy to the extent that we nurture others, not ourselves. Self-nurture is what we're into now. Not that you shouldn't take care of yourself. What has happened in the recent past is that we have departed from this. Most all the people are off the farm. Much of farming today is mechanized agriculture. So there isn't that much nurturing by very many people of our natural environment. We've industrialized, we're centralized into the cities, and we've gone from the human-animal bond having religion, pleasure, status, wealth, food, and friendship. And with industrialization, we've concentrated into the cities, separating a large segment of our population away from the natural environment, away from animals. And in more recent times, more people are living alone, fewer people are having children, although you wouldn't know that by being at Holden. But it's true for most of Western society. So our objects of nurture are gone for many people. And so we have what we have, an ill people, an ill society. But this bond has changed a great deal in the recent past. There's still some in religion, certainly in the Judeo-Christian religion, and we'll discuss this tomorrow on my talk on reverence for life. And we'll go into some of this. We won't have time to go into many of the religions, but certainly Judeo-Christian religion, the lamb and the dove are very important. Sacrifice of animals is important. And in many other religions, Zeus was a bull, the god Zeus. For the Zoroastrians, dogs and cattle are very important. And it's a long history. Now to go to more modern times, one of the first records of using animals in a helpful sense for the mentally disturbed was in Giel, Belgium, and it still continues today, where they brought the people in to live with them. This happens to be one of the first records for most people. That was in 1792 when the Tuke brothers, who were Quaker merchants, decided that the insane asylums of that time were terrible. So they set up by membership the York Retreat, which turned out to be very successful. And part of the therapy was that they not only dressed up the people for tea, had an education program, but they had animals for them to take care of, which was highly successful. And it was probably a model for that time until my very early youth. Florence Nightingale said this: a small pet animal is often an excellent companion for the sick for long chronic cases, especially a pet bird. In a cage is sometimes the only pleasure of an invalid confined for years to the same room. If he can feed and clean the animal himself, he might always be encouraged to do so. They didn't have women in the army in those days, except for nurses. And that was in 1859. The most remarkable visited is Bethel in Bielefeld, West Germany, where there were, when I was there, over 5,000 people who were handicapped and over 5,000 people who take care of them in some of the most remarkable facilities you'll ever see, and I recommend that if you're ever there to go and see it. Here you see some of the people who live there, the residents feeding the animals. They have all assortment of animals there that are very helpful in their whole therapy regimen. I don't know why that's there. I guess I like the picture. In my parents' native Norway, Erlingen Anna Stordahl started a place called Betastolen, a sports plots up on the Valdres north of Oslo. And there's Erling Stordahl is a blind musician, so he caters also to blind people, but anyone of any physical or mental handicap. They teach blind people how to ski there, but very important are dogs and horses in their therapy. Here you see some of them are riding. It's been so very successful. In fact, they bought land near the Twin Cities, and I think they have something going there now, Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I did tell them it was a very good idea to build it there, because wherever you see Scandinavians, you see a lot of handicapped people. Since I'm one of them, I know. In the United States, the first utilization of these animals for a recording in a therapy situation was at Pauling Hospital in New York in World War II, when the Army Air Corps of that time, along with the American Red Cross, set up a farm associated with the hospital. It was highly successful, but they quit it because it cost too much in their determination of cost. This happens to be Boris Levinson, who's a clinical psychologist, was at Yeshiva University, and he was sort of the godfather of the present utilization of animals. It came up rather accidentally. He always had an animal. But on this particular day, he had his animal with him, which he never did when a patient was due. He wasn't expecting his next patient for a year, for an hour and a half or two, and suddenly the door came open, and here was his next patient. Of course, I guess if you would have had this child, you probably would have come early too. But mother went and filled out the forms, and the boy picked up with a dog, and they were having a pretty good time of it. And then the mother happened to see him and see if he's going to interrupt the proceedings. But Boris Levin says, no, let him go at it. And that started him out then on recommending this in many cases, that is really prescribing animals. And he did surveys, found out at that time even, a lot of people have utilized animals, clinical psychologists and others, but they don't talk about it. Because as he found out when he reported it, people would ask him if he shared his fee with the dog and things like this. It was not held in high repute. More and more now are utilizing it. And he wrote a couple of books about it, dedicated one to his dog Jingles. And he made a plea for structured studies. And two of the people that answered this were Sam and Elizabeth Corson, who are good friends of mine. They were studying a model for hyperkinetic children in dogs at a psychiatric hospital at Ohio State University. Some of the people who were there as hospital patients asked if they couldn't have access to the dogs, which they heard barking. They put him off for a while, and they says, well, why not? So Sam and Elizabeth went to the psychiatrist and said, you know, are there some patients who we could try on? They gave them their protocol, and they were very happy to do this because some of them were refractive to any kind of treatment they had tried. They just didn't do them any good of whatever they had tried. So he gave them a batch of them, and they were successful in all but one or two of them. But then he ran out of money, and he made the dogs available. And a fellow at the Castle Nursing Home in Millersburg, Ohio, says, they're there for me, because he had noted how the patients responded to him when he brought his animal around the premises, which was a very large facility. So they took the dogs there. And I'll only tell you about one of them because it's a very celebrated case and a very impressive one. And that's Jed, who was aphasic, had been since for the 26 years of his life there. He said a word now and then or a grunt, but that's about all he did. And so he'd had a history of dogs, so Corson brought him this dog, and old Jed said, y'all brought that dog, which was more words than he'd said in 26 years, asked if he could keep the dog, and certainly could. And by this, he was socialized, and he began, of course, talking to people. And he also started tracing pictures of dogs, and then freehand drawings of dogs, and this is a very important picture because you'll notice that both creatures are smiling. They're having fun. And that's probably our best therapy today. And it reminded me of a study done by one of my dearest friends named Michael McCulloch, who's a brilliant psychiatrist. He was also on our faculty of our regional program in veterinary medicine for the Northwest here, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, for which I had responsibility. He was also had appointment at the Oregon Health Sciences University. He did a study on the effects of animals on people. You can read it as well as I. But the one that was 100% was it helped me to laugh and maintain a sense of humor, which I think is very, very important. But you see a lot of other great benefits. Here are some more of them. Helped me to cope with isolation and loneliness, which is a subject we'll be discussing next week. Source of companionship, made me feel needed. Distracted me from worry, and that's what we'll discuss on Wednesday because of what we've seen in children's wards in hospitals. And this is Michael. I felt you should see Michael. He always believed that his children should have pets. More recently, he got a kid for his pet, and that's Molly. The story has a very sad ending, however. Michael was, as I said, a very close friend of mine. He was also vice president of the Delta Society and one of the founders of the Delta Society. On June 26th of this year, 2 years before that, a former crazed patient came into his downtown offices in Portland and blew his brains out. And that was a real tough one to take. When I got to be dean in a fit of senile dementia, I did my second real introspection. When I was in prison camp in the war, I had a lot of time to think. And I rethought my position in 1972-73 as to where my profession should be going and where people should be going relative to animals and in society. And I'll tell you what I found. I found out some very bad news. I talked to a lot of veterinarians, and I asked them what percentage of your clients are irresponsible animal owners. I only had one answer, less than 50%. In 74, 75, up to about 18 million dogs and cats were killed in our animal control centers that year. And that's a lot of blood on the floor. You say, well, they were just strays. No, 80% of them were owned by someone. 35 to 50% of them were there because of behavioral problems. That portended very badly for the future. A lot of, as I say, bad treatment of animals, which happens to be very wrong. The wrong person was in charge of the pack. Dogs were not trained well. This says it's man's best friend and it can't even hit the fire plug. So we had a serious problem, a very serious problem that I felt we had to do something about. And the real clincher was what I found, because I was raised by Norwegian parents in this country as immigrants. There were two things that they stressed, was be kind to domestic animals, which I'll discuss tomorrow, and also for the handicap, and the old people. My mother would take me to visit old people. That isn't always the best source of fun, idea of fun for a kid. But I continued this through my life. And I'm going there a lot more now to nursing homes and convalescent homes because that's where most of my old girlfriends are. But what I found there was a lot of sad stories of people who were there, and the story went something like this. Sitting here waiting to die, nobody needed them. There were no objects of nurture. Many of them went there because they ran out of money. They were living independently, happy in their home, but ran out of money, or some well-meaning person laid a guilt trip on them and said, you really worry me, something will happen to you and I'll never forgive myself. So they hauled them off, said, we'll take care of the animals, meaning they killed them. Because in most places at that time, they didn't allow animals as they used to. And when I was growing up, all the prisons, nursing homes, convalescent homes, old people's homes, all had farms associated with them. When my father went there, they were not allowed animals. Huh? which happens to be very bad news. And so what they took away from this lady and a lot of others was the only thing in that point in their life that gave them unconditional love, socialized them, made them feel needed, gave them something to touch. Not many people touch old people, and they don't have much to touch. Helped organize their life. If it was a dog, it required exercise. And it socialized them, and it was a source of security for them. Now, there's no pill that'll do that for you today. And that's what we took away from them. That's why we worked so hard in the Delta Society and others to change the laws. Minnesota was the first law to allow animals in nursing homes again. We now have President Reagan signed a bill in 1983 to allow this. But it wasn't promulgated until this last year because getting the guidelines out, which we helped develop. So what we did about this, we decided that we had to do something. So we set up the People Pet Partnership, Linda Hines and I, who was formerly here on the, worked on the science committee. She's executive director for the Delta Society. And this consists of the Pet Education Partnership because if you're going to change the world, you start with the kids. Take a chapter out of the Catholic Church, get them when they're young and maybe you got them. Kellogg's the same thing. And the first program, of course, was the Pet Education Partnership. We take the animals into the grade schools. We're working on preschool to sixth grade. We like to have them contact with the animals. We set up a pet professor program. And there, with that dog, you can have four or five on one dog. It's very cost effective. We have a touch. We've recently developed a book. We've been teaching this. We went into our school system, and you probably find the same thing. There's a reason that animals today are throwaway items. They're recyclable items because nobody told the kids otherwise. They've trained them to have their animals be recyclable items. So that's what we set up a training program from preschool to sixth grade. We have a book here that's available. In fact, it's pictured there, which some of you are interested in. I'll tell you about it. And it's a graduated program trying to teach children a reverence for life, which is the name of a course I've been teaching now for 7 years in six different universities. And I'm reminded of Freud from what was said this morning in Pastor Magnuson's class, that children sow no trace of arrogance which urges adult civilized men to draw a hard and fast line between their own nature and that of all other animals. Children have no scruples over allowing animals to rank as their full equals. They don't make the line. The Native Americans and other cultures are the same way. With the coyote and salmon, for example, are very important in their culture, but they don't draw that firm line between animals and people. Companion Animal Partnership is another one of our partnerships, and I'll tell you all about that, or quite a bit about it, on Wednesday. We've developed guidelines for placement of animals in nursing homes. Supply is exhausted. The new supply will be out this month in a revised form. As a former prisoner, I've been very much involved in that aspect of this. Probably of all populations that could be assisted by animals, none could probably compare with what we've seen in prisons. I've organized an international committee on animals in prison, We set up a program in a maximum security prison for women at Gig Harbor. Here are some of the prisoners and others. Note the lady on second from the right. I'll only tell you about one case. It'll probably make a believer out of you. Angie had multiple seizures all her life, required the presence of her mother or father at all times for their first 14 years of life. She was confined to a wheelchair and strapped in because she'd have a seizure, which would be destructive if she wasn't tied down. And now and then her folks wouldn't catch her soon enough, so she'd black out and quit breathing, and then she'd lose whatever she'd learned. So they took her to the prison, and Sue trained a dog for her, trained a dog named Sheba for Angie. Angie now is throwing away her wheelchair. She's now taking junior high and high school work and living almost normal life because this dog tells her when she's going to have a seizure before she knows she's going to have a seizure. So she gives her a lot of leeway, you see. And she usually, in fact, she was in the Junior Handicap Olympics the other day on a handstand. The dog recognized from 20 feet away she was coming on to have a seizure, ran and got her. And she relaxes, lays down, pets the dog often, and has resulted in fewer seizures and not as severe seizures. And if it needs help, she goes and gets her folks and they can intervene. So this has been a remarkable success story. This is what caused me to suggest to a lot of people, hopefully they'll try it, that for probably epileptic children and probably adults, the right animal could probably help them similarly. Riding for the Handicapped is a fantastic program, most advanced in Germany and Europe, Scandinavian countries, that's where they started. It's called hippotherapy there, and they do some fantastic things. You can imagine a child looking up all its life on a wheelchair, looking at people up, suddenly vaulted on a horse, looking down, going places they've never been. A fantastic effect on them. And it goes for the same for old people. Probably the best week of this fellow's life was in our summer camp. He's a mentally handicapped fellow. And this is the Delta Society, involved in people, animals, health, and allied professions, in research, service, and education devoted to that about people, animals, and environment. And some of the research, I think I'll postpone that until later. Maybe I'll take 2 minutes on this. This fellow on the left is a psychiatrist, University of Pennsylvania. Alan Beck is a doctor of science at the University of Pennsylvania. Aaron Katcher was involved in looking at the effect of touch and things and effect with Lynch and others at the University of Maryland. And they were following up on cardiac patients who had been hospitalized. And they did a social survey on them, about 80 or so questions. And a graduate student of Aaron Katcher's, he was not an animal person, his graduate student said, let's ask him one more question. Do you own a pet or not? And which they reluctantly allowed. They did a year's follow-up on these cardiac patients and found out that the only thing that mattered on their survival, had any effect on their survival, was whether they had a pet or not. Almost 30% of those that didn't have a pet were dead at the end of a year, while only 3 out of 53 that had a pet were dead. Changed his whole life, and he's now done most of his work on this kind of bonding. He's a brilliant scientist. I'll put this off until next time. This is a lady that uses her dog for, did her PhD, in fact, Boston College, on her dog with 12 serious juvenile offenders, intense interviews, 24, 12 with her dog present, 12 without her dog present. Made all the difference in the world on what she learned about them. She now uses it in therapy. Here's one of our treasure for the Delta Society, formerly head of the Child and Family Service Department at the University of Illinois, where I just taught for the month of April. Through the years, one of the things I do, I go to art museums and I see where how many have dogs in them, or animals, and where the animals are in relation to the people. And recently they had a big contest nationally to find out where the animals were in relation to the people. We've known through the years that the animals have moved up. They're about right there now. They're almost level with the eyes of the person. Thought you'd be interested in that. If the conversation drags, you can tell people about that. This is, and the Department of Defense has now one of our former students who is also a social scientist. He's a consultant to the Surgeon General of the Army on the human-animal bond, and doing some remarkable things, which I'll tell you about. Dogs are now in quite a few wards. This happens to be the Children's Hospital in Denver. And the physicians are now not only have the animals in the children's cancer ward, but they've extended to all other wards except newborns and the intensive care unit with great success. So RX is being placed now on animals. We'll be discussing grief in animals and people, and distress and suffering later this week. But if you tame me, this is one of my favorite books, incidentally. But if you tame me, then we shall need each other. To me, you will be unique in all the world. To you, I will be unique in all the world. For you become responsible forever for what you have tamed. And we take that responsibility very seriously, and we must. And that's the dogma for tonight.